Is that headphone too loud?
No, it's not too bad, thanks.
That's good. Yep. No. Lovely, Ben. This is bloody cool. Someone who's followed the Big Game Record Series from afar, from Scotland. You're in the country, and just so happens you're staying in Tauranga and could make the drive up. Thank you so much. This is awesome.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so people will know you as the Roadier guy. And I was sort of talking to you that in the books, Bamor talks about how we didn't get to introduce them, and you had the reason why they'd be no good to bring across the ocean.
Yeah, well, probably most likely reason is that, well, for starters, roe deer really don't like people, so the idea of having them caught up close to people on a boat for goodness knows how many weeks or months would not work. But when they come into contact with people, they can get extremely stressed. So, like, the most common scenario where it happens is that they'll maybe be involved in a road traffic accident. People with the best intentions will go along to kind of help the deer, and their stress levels just go through the roof, and it can bring about a condition called capture myopathy, which is essentially basically a stress-related heart attack that'll happen at some stage after that. And it's the same reason that in Scotland we've got a really good sort of tourist venue, if you want to call it, in Fife, called the Scottish Deer Centre, which has a whole heap of different types of deer. In the past, they used to have roe deer there, but they don't anymore, just because they're not suited to that sort of environment. But it's a great place to go along and see a variety of different deer up close, and it gets people that are perhaps not from a hunting background or a countryside background to get a bit of knowledge about deer and why they're important and why we need to manage them and look after them.
My soon-to-be wife's aunties have just been to Scotland, and that was the statement they said, that there is deer everywhere. They brought me back some nice socks with deer on them. Is it there literally deer everywhere?
Yeah, pretty much. They're across Scotland. There's a number of different species of deer. And yeah, you'll find them. I'm based in the Central Belt, so I'm about an hour north of Edinburgh, and where I am, there's solely just roe deer. But a little bit further up the road, if we go into Tayside, you'll start to encounter fallow deer as well, and red deer. Roe deer will also be present. There's also sika deer, which there's populations of them in Scotland down in the borders, across on the west coast. So yeah, there's certainly a good amount of deer, and currently in Scotland there's quite a number of changes taking place. We've had recent changes to the legislation surrounding deer, and there's further proposals ahead as well, which essentially part of it is geared at reducing the deer density across the whole of Scotland.
So what are they trying to preserve?
They're basically, it's linked into stuff like looking to enhance the natural habitat. In Scotland, when you go to the Highlands, traditionally from like the Victorian era, a lot of the ground is managed as a grouse moor, so it's open heathland, and there's no trees. And in the past, like a long, long time ago, there would have been trees in some of those areas. So, just thinking off the top of my head, an example of an estate that's undergoing a massive amount of regeneration, and their kind of objective is, they'll say that they're working to a 200-year plan, is an estate called Glenfeshie, which is up in the Highlands and Cairngorms. They've done a huge amount of replanting and done a huge amount of work to reduce deer numbers, and are starting to see a real big change in the habitat and
replanting of forest.
Yeah.
What are they planting?
They are planting a lot of native species, and then they're enabled.
So what was native for Scotland?
Well, depends at what height they're they're at. So actually, as it happens, when on the plane across, I was watching a wee documentary about them. So they like up in the higher ground, they were planting trees. I think it was willows and stuff like that. Were up really high, which had been sourced from the local area. And then further down, they're planting broad leaves, and so yeah, I'm not entirely sure what their species of trees and stuff would be there, but there's been a massive change there in terms of going from a traditional estate. So your traditional Highland estate would never be a big money making enterprise per se, but what they would offer would be like grouse shooting and also deer accompanied deer stalking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in order to offer the traditional deer stalking, you tend to need to have a good number of deer
mm-hmm.
present. And so to put that into sort of perspective, I can only relate it to my stalking experience. So I previously worked as a professional stalker, where worked contracting. So the estate I was at was at Athol Estates, which is up near Blair Athol. And I was on a week called West Hand, which would be about 20,000 acres. And in terms of the amount of deer that we were taking off of then, back in the early 2000s, we were doing about 150 stags with guests.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, it's recently changed. We've recently removed in Scotland. There's no longer a season, a closed season for male deer, but back in the day, it used to be from July through until 21st of October, you'd be at stags. So it's quite a short window of time.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd be pretty busy with taking guests out basically 6 days a week.
Would there be rutting?
Yeah, you would. The rut would start. You'd tend to, if the weather was cold enough, you'd usually tend to catch it just from sort of the first week of October onwards. Depending on how the weather was, sometimes it'd be a wee bit delayed, and sometimes it'd be quite common that they'd be rutting after the end of the season
mm-hmm.
Too.
And how familiar were guests with that sort of concept?
Oh, certainly there we'd guests that would come back year on year. Yeah. You know, like the same week each year would be quite often the same family were coming back year after year.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would vary as well, and that's what I really enjoyed about it. You got to meet so many different people from so many sort of backgrounds. It could be somebody that had been coming there every year with their family. And on odd days as well, you'd have guys that maybe saved up, because that, well, it still continues to be, if you're going doing traditional stalking, it's quite an expensive
mm-hmm.
Hobby. Certainly in Scotland, we don't have as much access to the public land that, mm-hmm. that you do here in New Zealand. So at that time, you would be, yeah. It probably, if you're going to go shooting a stag in Scotland, you'd probably be looking at equivalent of just over $1,000 New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you could.
And what was sort of the, what made a trophy in Scotland?
Well, in terms of a trophy, you've still got your kind of quintessential standard of your royal, which is, you know, your 12 point stag, but the inference on the traditional estate that we were at, it was more your trophy was kind of the whole encompassing experience of the day, and the stag that you were ultimately taking could quite often be a management stag that the trophy per se was kind of for the benefit of the rest of the herd. So an example would be if you take you through your average day stalking red deer out on the hill, it's pretty civilized. You'll tend to leave the accommodation that you're staying in. We would go and collect the guests at 9 o'clock. We'd drive up onto the hill
and park
a view out in Land Rovers. So we'd drive out a few miles onto the hill, get parked up, and then walk out from there. And the walk for the day could be anything from 3 to 12 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be pretty hard going in places as well, like when there's contract stalking in the West Coast, you'd be going from sea level to 3,000 feet every day.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of part of the experience as well. It's not just about pulling a trigger and shooting a red deer. It's about being in their environment. It's about seeing and hearing everything that goes with that, and especially during the rut. Scotland in October can be a pretty damp place, and it's quite common to get the hill fog rolling in. And crikey, when you're up on the top say, and you've got the hill fog rolling in, you can hear stags roaring. There's nothing like it. Mm. It's just the best. But you know, so we'd have the guests out. You'd see groups of deer, and you'd stalk into deer, and your trophy that you might be taking would perhaps be something that we'd call a switch. So that would be like a stag with big straight antlers that obviously in a confrontation with another stag could pose quite a threat and even kill them. So that would be taken.
Mm-hmm.
And then at Athol, we used ponies. So assisting me, I'd have a ponyman who I'd give a shout on radio,
mm-hmm.
and guide them into where we were. And we'd load the stags. It's a special sort of saddle that they have. Load the stags onto the saddle and then walk down back to the vehicles and stuff with the ponies. So it was a complete experience, if you like, of which pulling the trigger and shooting the deer is just a very small part of it.
Yeah. So what was the rules around pulling the trigger? Did they get to go and do a few shots and things, but bring their own arms, or?
Yeah, it would depend. Sometimes people would bring their own rifle. Other times they'd use what we call an estate rifle, which is basically your stalker's rifle. It's provided as part of your job, because when you're not out with guests, you'll tend to be culling animals yourself. And what would happen if at the start of the week, or you know, when they're arriving, we'd go to Target and check the rifles and check they're comfortable. And in that scenario as well, when you're taking clients out, it's nothing like the long range shooting that you'll tend to see here in New Zealand. Most of the time on the hill, we would be shooting stags 100 to 150, 180 yards away most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a case of the stalker would identify where the deer were, what deer you were looking to selectively kill. You would guide the guests in with you. You would set up the rifle, and you would then talk the guests through and make sure that they were on that animal that you wanted taken, and keep them calm and progress from there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's quite a very managed situation. But a lot of the time, a lot of the guests that were coming were well experienced with that, and it's part of their experience they're getting to do that, and they're not necessarily not all of them are accomplished deer stalkers, so they don't always have the skills to get themselves into that position in the first place. So
are they taking part in the spotting?
You definitely actively involve them in seeing the deer and getting them onto that. And although I must say the most infuriating thing as a stalker can be if you have a deer spotter with you,
mm-hmm.
because it's not a case that every single deer that you see when you're out on the hill you're going to go and try and stalk into, but sometimes some people would get a wee bit focused, or concerned rather, that you were walking past deer and maybe think that you weren't quite up to what you were aiming to do, but oh no, we got there.
What would you sort of do? Acknowledge the sighting, but say that's not what we're looking for, or
it would depend because sometimes it does get a bit wearing after a while when you've got somebody who maybe like 3, 4, 5 times of a morning is interjecting, trying to and you're trying to put them at ease and let them know, because it's not a sprint either. But I remember one guy in particularly was he was part of a party of two, and he was a shocker. And so to try and kind of get him settled down and to kind of stop him interrupting the morning, as it were, had him up for the first shot, and got him in nice and settled, like just nice wee shot off 160 yards away. Well, you can guess what happened. He put it over the back of the deer, and it didn't. So we had to opt for that was the straw that broke the camel's back. So
had he missed?
He'd missed after all his
thankfully
advice and guidance.
Yeah.
So it was a case that it was a guy, the guy that was out with him was a guy, remember, who was a really, really decent guy, a guy called Charles Benny, who at that time he was head of a company called the Sovereign Group. And it's funny, sometimes you remember guests just because of stories and that you tell him, and he was a real character. And he enjoyed, he obviously did pretty well in his business and that, but one of his kind of hobbies as such was putting up money and encouraging young bands to try and get them to break through on record labels and that. The sort of stuff you talk about when you're out in the hill with guests and that, but really nice guy. And so was me that had basically been antagonizing me all morning, just decided to go with a kill him with kindness sort of move. And he was out for his very first deer, never shot a stag before, and rut was just starting, so you know, we had that in our advantage. And I think I managed to get him in. He actually went in the last wee bit, and he shot his very first stag from less than 30 yards away. And that's a completely wild stag that you know, would not stand there if it knew a person was there. And that was the kind of big smile for his mate that had been a bit of a pain and then missed his opportunity. But we got his mate a deer on the way home as well. The day wasn't lost totally, but you know, but that's kind of the way that the sort of hunting day would go there. It's about people undertaking an experience and about appreciating the environment that these deer live in. And without a doubt, red deer are an iconic species of Scotland. You know, we were talking earlier about red deer in New Zealand, and I was saying how I used to live down in central Otago, and well, a lot of the deer that came were there. They came from some of them came from an estate at Invermark, which is up in the Angus Glens, and it's just incredible to think of the journey that those deer went on, and they lucked out when they got here, because certainly
it was the good feed for them, that's for sure.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, I think Bamwell seems to think that protecting the Otago herd is paramount, because basically the only genetically scotious purebred left, like you said, the Seeker and stuff that infiltrated, and various, I think you said there was some repopulating of Scotland from parks in England, which have other genetics to them. And so yeah, but the Otago herd's in danger of having the same fate. I think
certainly in Scotland, the Seeker have hybridized with red deer in some instances, and I think there's only a few islands on the west coast that may perhaps be able to withstand and preserve a pure bloodline. Which is, it's a bit of a shame. But then another hand as well. Nothing stands still.
No, you know, that's
and
right.
It's a great shame for the Central Otago herd, but without a physical barrier, I don't know how it could ever be prevented, really.
Yeah, I had that one the other day from the Jolly, and someone made the comment, oh, isn't that an Otago one? And I said, oh, for a very long time, the Ben O'Howe and the Tasman River formed a barrier, but I would say up the top of those valleys, and especially with the West Coast and things, that Rakaia and Otago have intermingled. Yeah. And then same coming around from Waketipu, that herd will have come around into the Wanaka and West Coast as well. So, yeah, it's not, as we said, it's pretty in danger. But, yeah, what Chris has done at Hawea seems to be looking at the proper shape.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got the deer farm there as well. So, you know, it'll take some skill to try and maintain that way. Yeah. I wonder if Chris would ever genetic test them. That'd be fascinating.
Yeah, well, in Scotland, there is a database for red deer. There was recently a series on BBC called Highland Cops,
mm-hmm.
and there's a cop based up at Inverness called Dan Sutherland, where he was featured on it. They had a poaching incident.
Mm.
Where somebody had shot a couple of red stags and they didn't have permission to be on that ground. And what happened was they recovered the gralloch, as we would call it, which is basically your gut bags,
mm.
so your stomach and stuff, and they'd swabbed blood in the back of the pickup, and they also managed to recover the carcasses,
mm.
and the gralloch got cross-matched with the deer carcasses, and there's a brilliant scientist called Dr. Lucy Webster, who mm-hmm. specializes in forensic recovery DNA from animals, based for SASA down near Edinburgh, and she helped with that, and yeah, it was pivotal for that case, and they got a conviction, which was pretty remarkable.
Amazing. Yeah, Bamwell and Jamie, you're going to kill me. I've forgotten your last name right now, but interesting, the Scottish link. The sort of land care research branch in Mosgiel was called InverMay, and that's where the genetic database for deer is in New Zealand. Yeah, and they obviously were part of testing the Otago herd and New Zealand deer genetics. So all the farm genetics go through InverMay down there in Mosgiel. So, yeah,
it's super.
It's quite interesting that. Yeah, if that all the farms can test their genes, so you know why can't we grab a few hairs off the beast and send it in?
Yeah, but I think the trouble is that yeah, it's establishing that wild sort of database. It mm. needs a lot of help from certainly that's where hunters can definitely play a part in
mm.
contributing towards that. But like everything, it's something that will need funding.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah,
so. Where do the roe deer come in? Are they hunted on estate or?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate. I started deer stalking when I was about 17, so unfortunately that's 31 years or so now. So I've over that time, I've got quite a number of farms in my locality where I help out the landowners by looking after the roe deer.
And what are they farming?
It's a whole variety of farms. So where I am, there's a lot of intensive arable mm-hmm. operations and a lot of vegetable growing and some mixed farms as well with like beef cattle and sheep. But roe deer are browsers as opposed to grazers. So that basically to explain that, they're like little bits of lots of different things as opposed to just hone into a field of grass per se or whatever. But
so they got a diet more like a red deer than a fallow deer.
Yeah. But where they can kind of have a bearing on agriculture is particularly with vegetables. And where I am as well, with carrots. Because we have the cold winters, what happens a lot of the time is that they'll cover the carrots in straw, which protects them from the frost. Straw isn't much of a barrier to a roe deer, though, who can smell the lovely, sweet, highly calorific carrots underneath the straw. They'll come along, dig away the straw, exposing the carrots. They'll take a bite out of a few of them. They'll eat away at them. And then, of course, any that they've bitten are wrecked, but the areas that they've cleared are then open to frost, and yeah, it just goes on. And then in the summertime, one of the farms that I stock at thankfully doesn't grow anymore, but used to grow lettuce. So that would involve like plastic sheeting for the seed beds across. And of course, roe deer run across fields, don't they? So they'd put holes in all the plastic, and yeah, a nightmare.
Weeds everywhere.
Yeah, but it's about trying to find that balance, and it depends on different landowners have different objectives. So you might have, I've got some landowners that are looking for just basically population management. They're not looking for the deer to be eradicated. They're looking for a natural surplus, if you like, to be taken off, or numbers to be reduced where there's damage that's evident. So we've had a lot of tree planting initiatives underway, and with that, roe deer, the males, the bucks, in the springtime, when they're casting their velvet and establishing territories, will fray a lot of trees. So that's kind of an aspect that we try and manage around. Excuse me.
Get some light on the scene.
Oh yeah, no bother.
And so these guys, how do they employ you? Do they employ you privately or via your wildlife work?
Well, there's a whole load of different ways that you can access land to manage deer in Scotland. So yeah, we there's a couple of exceptions, but we don't tend to have public land access per se. So your way into it might be through like paying to be part of a syndicate that rents ground, or I'm very fortunate in that a lot of the ground I get on, I don't have to pay to be on. The kind of deal is that we'll share the venison, and you know, our family's a wee bit like, what's his name in Forrest Gump, with the Bubba Shrimp, you know, kind of venison lasagna, venison bolognese, venison burgers, venison steaks, venison all that. So, yeah, and what I do as well, basically, in Scotland too, the sale of venison is restricted by law. So if I had shot a deer and I was wanting to sell you venison, or I gave you venison, you were like, oh, I need to give you some money for that or whatever, I would need to, at the moment anyway, have a venison dealer's license to do that, which I don't have because I'm purely doing it now on a recreational basis. So I do process a lot of deer, and I'm lucky enough to have a tolerant wife that let me put in a kind of deer processing room at the bottom of my garden.
Yeah.
I just give away to family and friends. But like I say, we eat quite a lot of venison ourselves. So yeah, but I just see it the best of both worlds, that I get to spend time out in the countryside. I'm lucky enough that a lot of it's on my doorstep. I'm then able to ethically harvest a sustainable meat source, enjoy being out in nature, and then have the advantage of following that food the whole way through the whole process. So a lot of the meat that we eat as a family, well, first of all, the deer never knew I was there. It's spent its last moments in a environment it's familiar with. It's totally at ease, it's not stressed. I've then recovered the animal, checked it over, ensured that it's not got any disease. And then it's kind of less than 2 miles home to the chiller, and then processed, and you don't get kind of better than that. It's something I think that a lot of people don't really sometimes take for granted when they see the meat that's on their plate, regardless of what meat source that is, but about the journey that animal's had from birth to that point that's on your plate. And like, I am somebody that absolutely, I eat steak every day. I love steak and I love pork and lamb and that. But in terms of a truly, like, exceptionally ethical and sustainable product, wild venison, you ain't going to beat that, you know. And it's a case of, certainly in most instances, trying to manage the deer to produce that resource without overly impacting the environment, or, you know, overly impacting other land management interests in that area. And that's kind of what we set out to do.
Yeah, nice. What calibre are you using for them?
At the moment, I am using 270. We have different, well, we obviously have different firearms licensing laws in the UK. So basically there's caliber restrictions on what is the minimum caliber you can use on deer. So without going into the actual splitting hairs figures, basically for roe deer in Scotland, your smallest caliber that you would be able to lawfully use is a treble 2. And for red deer, fallow deer and sika in Scotland, your smallest caliber is pretty much going to be a 243. So I like to just work away with the one rifle, so it's totally familiar to me and it's less kind of faff, if you like. So the 270 for me does everything. It's a caliber that I'm able to get ammunition for pretty easily, which is key. I had a brief spell, I had a 708 where years ago I was in contracting in an estate on the west coast of Scotland and the Ardnamurchan Peninsula, a beautiful place called Kingairloch, and the stalker that was there had this Sarco 708, and I just remember being out a couple of times and seeing him use it and see the kind of job it did with deer, and I was like, wow, I'd really like a 708. So saved up and decided, right, you know what, I'm gonna treat myself here, and I got in touch with a riflesmith and got a semi-custom Tika, totally done to my spec. Came and put in a Macmillan stock, had it Cerakoted exactly as I kind of envisaged it, got out, took it to the target, and it was as accurate as an accurate thing, just hated it. Absolutely hated it. Just, I couldn't get on with it. It was just like, oh, it was just everything about it. I was the person that had said, oh, I'd like this, and it was a lovely rifle. I just couldn't get on with it. I'd been slightly sidetracked as well, because I'd been saving up, and I was umming and on about a blazer, just from the easiness of being able to strip it and whatever. So I went to a blazer demo day and had a shot of one, and right enough, it was really nice. But then when you saw the price, it was like, maybe I'll be fine. I'll just get a semi-custom. That'll do. And no, it wouldn't.
So you got buyer's remorse, and you broke the rule of hunting equipment, buy one and cry once.
Yeah, exactly. But I did get a slight reprieve, where I was very, very lucky to find, through the good old joys of the internet, I found a guy on a forum who had a blazer that hated it.
Oh, good.
So and he wanted a semi-custom Tikka 708. So, like most things, chuck a bit of money at it and it sorts the problem. So yeah, we got there.
Yeah, what is it? Values been money exceed. No, I can't remember the word. Doesn't matter. Yeah. Oh, very cool. So, how are you stalking these animals on these farms?
On these farms, roe deer pretty much tend to be active very first thing in the morning and towards last thing at night.
Mm-hmm.
Especially as well, because we're in the central belt, that means that during the day there's like a lot of human interference in terms of dog walkers, cyclists, as I'm sure happened in New Zealand on the back of lockdown. It means that people no longer adhere to footpaths, they walk here, there and everywhere. So with that, it's not really feasible to be doing too much stalking during the middle of the day unless you're somewhere pretty remote. But for the most part anyway, the deer are very active first thing in the morning, last thing at night. So the way that I approach it is I go out on foot and just, you know, skirt about using vegetation and being conscious of wind direction. Just your basic stalking principles. In some instances, I don't personally have any, but it's quite common for other hunters to use what they call a high seat. So basically,
mm-hmm.
a ladder with a seat at the top of it with a shooting rail, and they'll go and sit up in that. I quite like to be on the move.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I tend to just walk about and sometimes, you know, stop overlooking a wee valley or a glen or whatever and take time. But without a doubt, the biggest aid that I have for deer stalking is to use a thermal monocular as well,
mm-hmm.
which is just completely revolutionary for finding deer and just for seeing a whole host of different wildlife that you would walk on by, you know.
And are you, like you say, you're using vegetation to hide, but are you on open ground or?
Yeah, so a lot of it'll be arable farmland. So, yeah, you're. Sometimes it's almost like being back on the hill stalking red deer. Sometimes, in that you're using the natural undulations and being very conscious of the wind direction as to getting you into a shootable position.
Mm-hmm.
But other times it's pretty straightforward. Coming down the side of woodland and, you know, your background's covered, the deer can't really see you. But, you know, they're like every deer, the roe deer, and that, you know, the biggest giveaway for you is your sense of smell,
mm-hmm.
And then movement.
Will they, if you stop, will they stare at you for a while and calm down, or?
Sometimes.
Like you said, they don't like humans.
Yeah, they don't tend to like humans, but you can sometimes get a, it just depends, it's like everything, there's no hard, fast rule, but sometimes if you've moved and, say, an animal becomes alert and looks at you, if you stand rigidly still, sometimes you can get away with it and they'll glance away.
Mm.
But yeah, no, it depends as well on the stalking pressure. So if they're, I tend to, because I'm lucky to have quite a few farms, I'm not going out to like the same farm every Saturday and Sunday. I'll tend to go there for 2 or 3 days at a time and then rest it, and go to another place, and that really helps settle things down. And it also helps the deer kind of fill in the gaps, because they're excuse me, they're very roe deer are very territorial. So when you're removing males and females, you will get somebody coming into that slot at some point, because especially when you're removing maybe more mature males that are perhaps dominant, and it's quite common. So like in, say, a forestry plantation that's at a stage where it's at greater risk of damage by roe deer fraying, it's quite common that some people would just leave an older buck alone that's in there, and he'll do the job of keeping away the young vandals, if you like. Because if you go in and...
So he won't go and strip and dig up and...
Not to the same degree.
Okay.
Not to the same degree, but you'll get your young roebucks just coming in like a bunch of thugs and...
Making a mess.
Yeah, just the equivalent of like tagging railway carriages or whatever everywhere, saying, oh, we're going to make this our place, but by leaving an older fella there, he'll sometimes keep out. But it's, you know what, it's not an exact science. And I think that for me anyway, the key thing for my involvement in deer stalking is enjoying it, and, you know, learning as much as I can, appreciating that you'll never know it all. I'm really enjoying now. I've got two daughters, and both of them enjoy coming deer stalking, and to be able to pass on wee bits of information about deer and why they're important, hopefully that'll mean that when they're a bit older, they'll participate in it and make sure that it's a resource that's preserved for future generations.
Absolutely. Now, you said they tend to replace themselves in twos.
Yeah, well, typically roe deer are quite special for a number of reasons, but with their breeding cycle, they have a thing called delayed implantation. So typically the roar, or the rut, if you like, tends to be kind of last week of July, first week of August.
What's the sound? Is it sort of a shouty sound?
Yeah, it's like a barky... their alarm call is like a barky sound, but they're around the mating time, you can call in a deer at the roe rut, and it's like a wee peep peep sort of caller, which mimics, depending how you're doing it, it can sometimes be to mimic a doe, other times you can do it softer and lighter to mimic a kid. So a kid's the term for a roe deer fawn, if you like, but they're called kids. And the theory being that when you do the wee kid sound, any does that are nearby will come running in to investigate, and the hope is that they'll bring a roebuck following them and you shoot them. And other times, you can do like a distress call for the doe, which will basically mimic a doe being hounded by a buck. And the theory would be that you're then encouraging another buck to come and investigate, and kind of on the basis that, oh, it sounds like there's maybe a female. Female, yeah. So, yeah, but it's incredible. Like, they can come in, basically run over the top of you almost. I mean... I've heard a couple of times where, yeah, I think last year, closest buck I shot was about 10 yards away. Like, and it was a case of turning the rifle on its side because you couldn't look down the scope, sort of thing.
Yeah.
It was right on top of you. But it's an incredible experience. It makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck. You know, it's pretty something.
Far out. Yeah, and when they drop the kids, you were talking about the delayed Easter, sorry.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yeah. So they mate in the July, August, eggs get fertilised but don't really develop. And then it's not till, tends to be like from sort of late December into January. That,
boy, racing.
into January that it will start to, your embryos will start to develop.
Yeah.
So up until that time, you'll in the horns of the uterus, you'll get kind of look like two sort of peas, if you like, little corpus lutea, and that would be like when you were culling deer. So like when I went back to college and did my, I did an HNC, a higher national certificate in gamekeeping and wildlife management. And I was lucky enough that I was able to arrange my placement with, at the time it was called Forest Enterprise, which is basically, was the state forest company.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they collect all the data on their deer. So it would be routine that in the winter time, when we were culling the does before Christmas and that, we would examine their ovaries and stuff to see if there's corpus lutea present.
How many staff are doing that on various places?
Well, it's changed hugely. So it used to be like, I have a local forest to me. It used to be like a lot of local forests would have a ranger.
Yeah.
In it. So basically somebody that was employed that would manage the deer within that. That's changed quite a lot recently in years where, as forestry rangers have retired, they've not been replaced. Instead, they bring in contractors.
Mm-hmm.
So, in terms of deer management of like forestry and areas of land that are impacted by deer, what tends to happen in Scotland is people that are involved in the deer management will apply for, where it's applicable, a night authorization license, which will enable them to shoot deer at night. So there's been quite a shift, if you like, if you consider Scotland in, say, the 1980s, early 1980s, the majority of deer that were culled in Scotland would be probably culled during daylight hours. Night shooting happened, but wasn't like large scale. Now, there's a huge amount of night shooting goes on because of the management aims and objectives of private landowners and like Forestry Land Scotland as it is now. So there's a lot of guys that work incredibly hard shooting deer at night. And yeah, that was something, like when I went back and did my time at college, after I left college, I got a job working for a contractor. And yeah, it was full on.
So how many deer are we talking?
I was shooting then, or
they were coming in to examine.
Oh, well, when we were at the placement, that was about a four. I'm trying to think. I can't remember the size of the forest, but it was only about 120 roe deer a year we were shooting. So yeah, that'd be about 60. Roughly about 60 does, but out of that, in terms of checking for corpus lutea, you would only be checking about a third of that, because you'd be shooting most of your deer after the sort of January, mm-hmm. where it was more obvious. But with the contracting side of things, sort of you'd be recovering that data, but you'd also be recording exactly where the deer were culled, like taking GPS locations, and absolutely everything gets documented.
So what are the beliefs for that management, like What's the data they're wanting, and what is it for? Like the health of the herd, the disease, reproduction.
No, it's well, largely it's to do with the biodiversity objectives for Scotland, where in terms of climate change, and objectives surrounding that, are the drivers behind looking to reduce the deer density.
Mm-hmm.
So
they need to read the article that the Game Animal Council just published. It's not for carbon, it's for biodiversity.
Yeah. Carbon will definitely be in the mix there, because it's yeah, it's a
because they're trying to grow those forests. Is that why? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a extremely complex thing, the whole carbon thing. It's certainly not something that I'm well enough versed on to really have much of an opinion on, to be honest. But it's
that sort of also was driving the regeneration of forests? That is it carbon farming going on in Scotland?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and a lot of carbon sort of speculation, if you like. So, there's a lot of estates where, say, in the 1970s, or that, they would have drained peat mm-hmm. areas, so it was better for grazing sheep on, and then for management of the moor. There's estates now that they are actively flooding their mm-hmm. peatland. Because peatland, I can't remember off the top of my head what the figures are, but peat is capable of storing a lot more carbon than forestry, than trees per se. But then it's a whole complex thing as well. We've got different legislation going through in Scotland at the moment to do with the management of peatland. So, like, traditionally, there's a practice called muir burn, where heather would be burnt mm-hmm. in small patches, basically to an extent, you know, it's to aid red grouse numbers, because it creates smaller territories, it creates fresh growths of heather, which all benefits grouse.
Yeah, so burning the heather regenerates the heather, right?
Yeah. And it the with that it creates a what you're wanting to see. If you were looking at a hillside in Scotland, your ideal scenario in terms of managing it as a moorland for grouse shooting would be for it to look like a patchwork quilt. You know, because you would have all these different patches of heather all at different age growth, and it doesn't benefit just the grouse, it also benefits other species like lapwing and curlew, and then on top of that as well, because you've got all these birds and mountain hares and stuff there, you've got your raptors and everything as well. But there's currently opposing opinions on if that's appropriate for that moorland to be burnt, you know, or if it should be left. But then of course the problem is, if you leave it to grow unchecked, what it does is it increases the fuel load that's on the ground. So then if you get a drier spell, and, you know, we've had a few hot summers lately, and say a wildfire was to break out, by having that increased fuel load on the moorland, there's a real risk of the peat underneath. And that's a massive problem, because the muir burn method, it looks, to the uneducated eye, it's full on. It looks pretty bad, but it's a very quick. yeah, it does. But it's a very quick burn.
Yeah.
To the extent, I'm sure there's a Moorland Association last year demonstrated to some Scottish ministers muir burn, and they actually chucked like a Mars bar down in the heather and did muir burn over it, and you know, it wasn't. Yeah, because it's that quicker burn. You know, they did some sort of demonstration that showed that it, it took the top off it, sort of thing. So no, it was. We'll see what happens. So there's a big. It's an ever changing landscape, I think, in Scotland, as it is everywhere. But yeah, we'll just need to see what kind of happens. But the bottom line is that at the moment, a lot of data suggesting that the deer population is continuing to increase,
mm-hmm.
And that more deer need to be managed.
And so they're not grazing it from an agricultural perspective. They'd have to be pretty low density to be able to do that, would it?
How do you mean?
Like sheep and cattle.
In terms of
in the Highlands and stuff.
Yeah, no, it's still quite common for hill farms and estates to have sheep out in the hill, but some places they're reduced numbers, and that's the thing as well. That's what's difficult in the mix, is that the deer are sometimes would appear to be getting the blame, whilst set across the backdrop of a hill that's grazed pretty hard by sheep.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it's just such a complicated mix, because at the same time as well, we've got added protection for mountain hares. So you can have a situation where you have a forestry plantation that is getting damaged by hares, but you can't do anything to control the hares, and all you can do at that time is, you know, continue to put more pressure on the deer.
Yeah.
Which is debatable if they're doing the bulk of the damage. I mean, what you need to do around the hare side of things, there is options in terms of applying for licenses and things like that, but it's just, yeah, it's a complex thing, and like everything, there is no easy answer. Everybody's got their own opinions and ideas, and yeah, I for one certainly don't have the answers, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's trying to play nature, isn't it? That's where we're only trying to manage it, and it depends on the opinions of things. What's the value of deer now? Are they losing their value, or do you think they'll always be valued in Scotland?
No, I think they are retaining their value to most people. I mean, you look at aside from hunting, if you look at like the social media site like Instagram, and you put in a hashtag Glencoe,
mm-hmm.
one of the first things that would come up would be a red deer,
mm-hmm.
Because it so happens there's quite a lot of visitors there, and it's quite often quite tame,
mm-hmm.
Red deer. So certainly from that point of view, people are still valuing them. I think within the hunting community, absolutely, you know, people are valuing them as an icon of Scotland, but as a natural sustainable resource, you know, that yeah, like in terms of where I'm talking about, you know, the roe deer that I shoot, and the huge amount of venison my family and friends and enjoy from that, I mean, it's massive value. And as well for people seeing, you know, it's funny that, you know, we all, certainly where I am, people do tend to mostly live in towns,
mm-hmm.
and they'll drive through the countryside and that, and a lot of the time I don't think they maybe do appreciate what's there. But when people do tend to see deer, there does tend to be a positive reaction, you know, mm-hmm. people tend to have an element of surprise, and they're pretty grateful to have seen them. And I think that's sometimes what sparks emotion with people that don't really understand why we manage deer, why, you know, that sort of oxymoron of how can you really care about an animal so much and have so much interest in it, but you decide to kill it.
Any?
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but it's because I appreciate it so much.
Are there any predators left?
Not in Scotland, no. And we've had species reintroduced in the past few years in terms of like beavers.
Mm-hmm.
There's occasional rumblings from different groups about keen to introduce. Saying. Yeah. So, which I always find, particularly with wolves, I always find a very strange sort of thing to understand. So, you know, my only experience of where wolves have been mentioned is being from somebody that tends to be against hunting. So they would rather than the animal be killed in milliseconds, if you like, with a bullet, they would rather that it's chased for several, up to several miles and dies a slow lingering death by a pack of wolves.
Mauled. And not cats, where it'll hit it in the neck, ideally. It might grab it on its bum and then hit it in the neck.
Yeah.
But yeah, just mauled. Dogs will maul things.
Yeah. I fail to understand.
Did foxes do anything or no?
Well, interesting you say that. They'll predate the kids when they're first born. In fact, I'll need to have a look on my phone. I got sent a crazy video of it was a guy that was out stalking with his guest.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw a fox with a roe kid.
Wow.
And they shot the fox, and then they went, you see them walk up to the fox and kind of open its jaws, if you like, and the wee kid runs off, you know. But full on.
And are you allowed to shoot fox?
Yeah. You can shoot foxes, yeah. Yeah, what's changed recently, like traditionally in Scotland and in England as well, you'd have fox hunting packs, mm-hmm. but that's recently sort of changed. There's different legislation come in last year, which prevents that occurring without applying for a special license, which there's various conditions have to be met. So
that's chasing a fox, and
yeah,
so in that case a dog would get the fox, or
yeah in that case. So laterally what happened, there was a change in legislation in 2002, so as a result of that, what happened with fox hunting was that the aim would have been to have strategic guns placed out, so normally people with shotguns around an area where it was anticipated that a fox would run,
mm-hmm.
after hounds being put through a bit of woodland, but as I say, last year that changed, so that can only occur in specific circumstances.
Mm.
Most of the fox control that occurs in Scotland now will be with shooting,
mm-hmm.
Particularly with the night vision and thermal. The thermal technology is just incredible. And where it's beneficial for foxes as opposed to with deer is that most of the time with your fox shooting, you're out in open fields,
mm-hmm.
In the dark, so you've not got that risk of not seeing a object. Like sometimes your thermal scope might not necessarily pick up a wee branch when you're looking into a bit of cover where you'd maybe see a deer, whereas with fox control there's mostly not potential for that. It's mostly over grass fields or short crop fields.
Mm. And so what are you looking out for in disease
in terms of the
fox and deer?
Well, with foxes, your most sort of common thing that you'll encounter with foxes will be mange,
mm.
which is very evident in terms of their fur.
In Toxo? Or?
Well,
they'll just kill them.
It can... Well, I suppose it, a really mangy sort of fox could end up dead from it. From, you just get really itchy and scabby. And the thing that so I always find incredible with foxes is because they're so dirty in terms of the way that they live. You know, if you think about a fox there, they have their youngsters and they basically go to the toilet everywhere. Nothing's kept clean. They just move somewhere else once it's too bad. Whereas, and so as a result of that, it's quite common if they get a slight injury, it'll get infected and they get gangrene and die. Whereas that's often the thing that really surprises me with roe deer and deer in general is the injuries that they can survive.
Broken legs and
pieces
of other things.
I mean, like last year I had a buck which had a I noticed when I was back at the larder, he had a little bald part on his on the front of his nose, if you like, just on the front of his skull, just down from his eyes. And when I skinned the head, here was a bullet that was sitting, but it was the wrong way around. So, like, it was expanded on the outside, facing out, with, so my kind of theory on it was that he'd been unlucky in that he'd been, somebody had perhaps been shooting, hadn't seen him, and had shot a deer in front of him, and the bullet had gone through, tumbled, and ended up in his face, if you like. But he'd survived that. And I had another buck that had basically lost one of its front legs. I don't know if I'd been in a road accident or caught in a fence or fences tend to cause a lot of issues and I'd managed to
cause a lot of issues to fences.
But so in terms of disease in deer, we're able to put wild deer into the food chain in Scotland, but to do so you have to be what's called a trained hunter. You have to have a trained hunter number. So you have to have undertaken training. So in my case, I did a thing a good few years ago now called the Deer Management Qualification, where you do a level one, and then which basically involves a written exam and then a shooting test. And then I did my deer management qualification level two back in 2004, and that involved at that time you did a portfolio where on three separate occasions you go out stalking deer and there's an accredited witness with you who watches you stalk into the deer, watches you shoot the deer, then asks you questions about covering stuff like legislation, notifiable diseases, you know, ask you about why you maybe selected that animal or how it worked. It's quite a full-on process, and on the back of that, you know, you get your trained hunter number, which any of the deer that I'm not using for myself that are going through a game dealer, I have to sign on the label that I've checked the animal for disease. So when you're gralicking the animal, like removing the stomach and stuff, you're looking at the glands on the intestines and stuff, looking at the pharyngeal glands at the back of the neck and everything. You're looking at the hooves and stuff just for like signs of some like foot and mouth. Then when you're taking the pluck out with the heart and lungs, you're looking for any potential scarring on the lungs that might be TB. Then when you're happy that there's no sign of disease or anything like that, you're signing off and you add your trained hunter number.
Wow.
So then it's fully traceable through the process that rodeo number 123 came from.
Yeah.
Came from Ben, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's in your larder?
So in my larder, I managed to persuade one of my friends who builds agricultural sheds. He built me made out of insulated box profile panels. So yeah, I've got a nice concrete floor that makes it easy to clean down, and stainless steel table, and then I've got, because I'm only shooting a few roe deer at a time, I just have quite a small chiller.
Mm-hmm.
It's called it's a Landig fridge. It's a company in Germany that makes them, and they're purpose designed for keeping deer or wild boar and, or, you know, any game. And they're designed not to be plugged in and running all the time. You can turn them on and off, and the real benefit with them is to get down to temperature really, really quickly, and they're really easy to clean out. So I was very lucky. Before Brexit, I got my fridge, which meant I was able to, with typical German efficiency, email the company in Germany who put my fridge on a pallet, and the pallet then got delivered, and the guy basically wheeled it down to the bottom of my garden to where it's plugged in now, all for, you know, with a considerable saving over what it would have been at the time. There was a UK agent.
Yeah.
And I saved a good chunk of money, and yeah, it was great, and it's been a fantastic fridge. I wouldn't be without it.
And what tools are you using in the process?
Mostly knives and bone saw.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name of them. I've got a pair of these, they're like a game shear sort of thing, particularly with the ribs on roe deer, because there's not the fat coverage like you have with lamb and stuff. It's not the best for trying to saw through, but it's really easy to just nip in with the shear, so they work really well.
Have you done spare ribs venison?
Yeah, no, they're really good.
I
tend to do that, although especially during the summer months, I'll look to try and get as much trim as possible for making like burgers and things like that. Yeah, no, they're always pretty popular, and it's good, and try and branch out into new things like a goat jerky, and I've really enjoyed since I've been in New Zealand here, going to a couple of farmers markets, and there's definitely some really good salamis
there on Sunday in Hawke's Bay.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I had a chat to them, and I've not tried their bacon yet. I've heard good things about it, but I had some of their salami earlier today, and really great. And in terms of farmers markets, we obviously have markets at home in Scotland, but the Hawke's Bay one was just fantastic, really, really good. And is that another stall? I forget the guy's name. And he had like venison black pudding.
Oof.
And he does these venison beer sticks, which are insanely good. Yeah. It's really, really good. But as a farmer's market as a whole, just brilliant, and really good to see so many people there supporting it. And it helped. It was a good day.
Where are you trying to shoot your deer?
In terms of shot placement, it really varies in terms of what's what with roe deer, because we're in tightish cover. Most of your shots aren't far, you know. So you'll be, the majority of my deer are shot at less than 100 yards. So, because you've got high cover and stuff, I use a set of, they're called Viper Flex sticks, so they're like four quad sticks that go together. You can actually even put a fifth leg on them, which makes them absolutely rock solid, and they offer a really stable shooting platform. So a lot of
they've got a the rest on the top.
Yeah, the rest on the top. And they're expensive, but they're definitely a buy once, cry once, you know.
And you've shot a lot of deer.
yeah. The amount of deer I've shot that I wouldn't have got without them.
Yeah,
definitely well worth it. And with that, because they're so stable and because you're shooting at ranges you're very confident with and you're confident in everything you're using, a lot of the time I'll go for a neck shot if possible.
Yeah.
But any doubt at all, I tend to go for a chest shot.
Yeah.
Or, you know, through shoulders if you're in really tight cover, or, you know, looking for like a LR shot. Or,
and is that round getting much damage if you're going through the shoulder?
That's only animal. Downside, yeah, because it's a small animal. Yeah, you're writing off that. But it's the first priority is to make sure that we're killing the deer as quickly and humanely as possible.
Mm.
Yeah, as much venison as possible is nice, but it's secondary to that. So if I can be as sure as you can be when you're shooting at a live animal that, you know, I've got a good chance of a clean neck shot, yeah, I'll take that. But failing that, you'll just go for a slightly easier chest shot and at least make sure that you're better to have the deer back in the larder and have to trim off a bit more meat than not have it at all.
That last time I shot took a bit of taking down. It's not a good feeling at all. Yeah, it was just the angle shot in long tussock again from a prone position still, but on a high angle just was not very good.
Well, unfortunately, that's what can happen. You know, if you're out enough times and you shoot enough deer, you've got the human element and you've got the wild animal element, and in between you've got the natural environment. And with all those things spinning, sometimes something will go wrong. And I think the key thing is that you do get that gut feeling that just makes you feel awful. And I often say as well, even when everything goes right, the day that I shoot a deer and walk up to it and don't feel some sort of remorse, or, you know, like absolute admiration for that animal and appreciation that I was responsible for its clean death, if you like, and starting that process of turning it into food. The minute you're not appreciative of that and the sort of gravity of it would be the day I'd walk away from it, because it's I think people often misunderstand that sort of aspect. And, you know, it's like with antlers. People get weird about antlers, where it's like, it's essentially, any heads that I've kept are essentially like a 3D photograph of an event. And the alternatives were to either cut the antlers off and give it to, use it as dog juice, or put in the bin. You know, and I feel to myself it's a greater value.
Roebuck wouldn't be a very good knife handle.
No. Well, they can, some of them, it'd be a bit fiddly. I've still got the antler from my very first roebuck that I shot, which was a wee yearling, which was kind of just a Y shape.
Yeah.
Which I've often kind of thought, I don't know what we're going to do with that.
These guys, Alt Bays, they're Brazilian guys that live in Fitianga. I was on their podcast a couple of weeks back, but prior to me being on, they had a hunter on, and someone was saying about how they don't understand it, really, the whole antler thing. And I just sort of made the comment, all you should do in that situation, especially if you're unsure, is just ask the person, what's the story with that? And then watch what happens when they retell that story about that. And it won't just be like, oh, I went out and shot something. Like, I did this, I prepared for this, I'd been this, I'd investigated this, I'd done all this. I was tired, and then we brought it back, and then, like I say, I took it to the larder, and then we let it hang, and then we chopped it up, and then we shared it with these people, and, you know.
Oh, yeah, definitely. No, that's That's it. It's about, as I was saying earlier, it's about so much more than the one aspect of taking that animal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You caught a tadpole fish today?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, after yesterday's disaster of third cast in, managing to embed two trebles right up to the hilt in my arm. So, yeah.
So what did they do? What did they do for you? They chopped it off and pulled it out, or?
Yeah, well, yesterday afternoon was a whole host of emotions. So it was quite an annoying spinner. So got back to the batch and cut the spinner off so that it was just the hook. And I did actually have my brother-in-law ready with, I got a big bit of nylon and we were going to go for the grip and rip method, which I have done before when it's been a single hook.
Yeah.
And it has actually worked brilliantly, where you've put the loop of nylon round the kind of bend of the hook, held down the eye, and somebody's then yanked it so it's come out at the angle it went in.
Yeah.
And it does generally. But having a little wiggle and looking at it, kind of like, I don't think those hooks are at the same angle, and they were in pretty deep, so it
need
was
two in the area.
Yeah. So I did think then, maybe need to try and see if we can pop them through and cut the barb off, but that was not great. It wasn't sore, but it was one of them where it was like,
top of your forearm, right?
Just in at the back. It's healed all really well, just in there. But it was funny. Yeah, have a word with yourself, Ben. Just go to the hospital. So went and saw the great team at Taupo Health Centre, who put in some local anaesthetic and adrenaline to help stop it bleeding, and they had a good old wrangle and then they got it out eventually.
Legends.
Yeah, it was good. So we managed to get back. I was banned from having a cast last night when I got home, but managed to sneak out this morning. And it was a great morning. There was a lot of fish. We managed to get a fish each, and there was a lot of fish rising on the lake, and some amazing size trout there. Like, saw one head and tail out of the water that would easily be kicking double figures. And the water clarity is just incredible. It's insane how clear it is. And in terms of value, obviously I'm a non-resident, but it's $89 for the week.
Yeah,
which it's a world-class trout lake. Just can't complain at that. You know, it's money well spent. And
is there places where you can take in Scotland?
Yeah, absolutely. You'll get a range where there's like commercial fisheries.
Yeah,
so you'll get places like, for example, old gravel pit quarries and stuff that have filled in that are then artificially stocked with fish.
Yeah.
You'll then get like your rivers and stuff will tend to hold brown trout, and a lot of our rivers will have Atlantic salmon too, although unfortunately recently Atlantic salmon have been reclassified as endangered species. We've got massive issues in Scotland with water quality, the impact of fish farming, aquaculture, the open net. Fish farming has had a devastating impact on wild fish populations on the west coast of Scotland.
What do you mean by open net?
Where basically the salmon are out in net cages.
Yeah.
Out in sea lochs.
Yeah.
So the food goes in the salmon.
Mm-hmm.
The waste comes out and it goes on the bottom of the seabed. On top of that, because there's the high concentrations of the fish, you get huge concentrations of sea lice.
Mm-hmm.
And so the impact of that had been that your wild sea trout and salmon that have then been swimming past the fish farms get infested with sea lice, and it can have devastating consequences. So Yeah, and we've also got water quality issues in our rivers, with sewage going into waterways and then impact agriculture. And yeah, there's a lot of work to be done. And it's again, I mean, Atlantic salmon, total iconic species of Scotland, you know, and it's so important that we do everything to preserve them because they're such a important part of the biodiversity
So,
for
what you see
us.
with ocean locks, do the fish migrate up via them as well?
Yeah, it
Yeah.
can do, yeah.
And so, what are they closed off for?
What are the
The ocean locks, or is they just
are there
come tidally come in
yeah
and
just
out?
how
Oh,
yeah
yeah, okay.
yeah and they'll come in and come through. So like you'll tend to get your kind of sea loch coming in, and then you'll have tributaries off of that, so it'll be fish
Yeah.
coming up to get that. And just
So is that
the route
similar
that,
to like an estuary size thing, or?
oh no, it can be big. Yeah, it can be
It's often holding a lot of water, but it will be tidal. Yeah. And salt water.
Yeah,
Yeah.
there'll be some, yeah, you'll get a bit of tidal variance in them.
Yeah.
So yeah, but yeah, kind of like a sort of like an estuary,
Yeah.
yeah, would be a nearest thing here.
Oh wow. Yeah.
Yeah,
Must get
yeah.
there. Yeah. Oh goodness. Anything else you can think of, Ben?
I try and think. I mean, we talked about the, I
With
suppose,
Highland guiding and the stuff you did in South Island, like, is do the clients have meaning more with Scottish Highland deer, do you think?
well, I think that, you know, the thing that's deer stalking in Scotland, they'll always have is that historical reference that, you know, a lot of the sporting estates were really created back in the Victorian era. And I think, you know, when you go up to some of these estates and you see the incredible architecture that was put in, and there's that sense of tradition.
What are people typically hunt in? Modern hunting gear or traditional clothing?
No, your estates will tend to actually still wear tweeds. In
Yeah.
fact, I was, yeah. So as when I was at Blair Athol, I'd wear plus fours. So they were made to measure. Unfortunately, the company that made them, PJ Haggards, is no longer in business. They went out of business. But there's like, pretty sure it's Campbell's or Bewley. So there's well, would you say it was an outfitters? Basically, a shop that holds like each estate will have its own tweed.
Oh wow.
So there's like a, if you like, a library of different tweeds for different areas. So like if I put on my Athol tweeds, gamekeepers at different estates would look at that tweed and say, "Oh no, that's Blair Athol," you know. So yeah, they tend to still wear a traditional dress, and I must say, you can't beat a pair of tweeds up on a. They're incredible things. Like on a wet day, you just they don't get cold. You know, they are absolutely really comfortable to wear, and they're good to move in. And yeah, I was quite pleased with myself the other day because, crikey, it was basically 20 years ago that I was up at Blair Athlin, but I know I had all my old Athol tweeds the other day, and so I was like, oh, don't think I'd get into them again, but yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we were talking about Jerry McLaughlin now while I was making dinner, and yeah. They're very much in the merino the
Yeah.
merino way, and like you're seeing big brands like Kuyu and Sika go down that way, and like I always try to find merino hunting, because exactly right, the damp, you're bound to get wet in something that sort of holds its shape and warmth is can't beat it.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I definitely feel the cold now as I get older, and I spend basically all of our autumn and winter in an icebreaker at home, and
yeah,
I really rate the merino stuff. It's just so good, and once you've tried it, it's just so much better than the man-made fabric. Well, I personally find it is a, and it's just so resilient. And although it's reasonably expensive, in terms of the amount of wear you get out of them, it's incredible.
Yeah, buy once, cry once.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's an interesting thought when it comes to New Zealand hunting estate, like how you know, it's a reasonably new idea.
I don't know if like you tried to adopt a tweed situation here, it'd be a bit false, eh? I think back when I was working with Brendan, my wee Brendan Matthews trophy something in embroidered fleece was about as high tech as we were getting for the kind of estate identification, if you like. it did what I needed to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So people find you on Instagram at The Roadier Guy, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And yeah, all it is just I'm really keen on my roadier stock, and I just share some of the stuff that I do around that on there. And like I say, it's always a learning process. I've been doing it for a little while, but there's always more to learn, and it's the enjoying thing is the journey.
Yeah. And what's the documentary or series coming up?
Oh, last summer I did a bit of filming with Nature Scott, who are there like the equivalent of Doc in Scotland. So I'm one of three recreational deer stalkers featured on it, and it's just about showing how some people in their spare time go about helping landowners manage deer. I was very fortunate, the conditions were good when the guys came out with me, and we had a good evening, and it was nice to be able to share a wee bit of what we do on that. It was good. Yeah.
Plenty of drone footage.
There is a wee bit of drone footage, actually. Yeah.
So we'll get a taste for the countryside.
Hopefully. Yeah. I've my last update from them was they were still in the edit mode. So I've not been privy to see where it's at. But yeah, hopefully it turns out all right. And it's just to show people a wee bit of how some people do it. I mean, I obviously do things my way, and there's always going to be room for improvement, you know. But it was good to have it out, and like I say, I get a huge amount of enjoyment from deer stalking, and I've had a huge amount of enjoyment from the people that I've met doing it. And yeah, like I say, well, here we are, we're having a chat about it, and we got talking on Instagram about deer stalking and stuff, and it's all part of it. So yeah, no, thank you very much for having me, and it's good to catch up with you.
It's very cool, and like I say, your perspective's different to everyone else's. You've got a taste of New Zealand, you've got a taste of Highland stuff, and then like I say, open ground in the middle of Scotland is very cool, and I hope can look forward to seeing that and two other people's perspective as well.
And it's incredible, like the drive up here, it's incredible how much New Zealand does look like Scotland in many senses, and that was definitely a big help for me when I made the leap of coming off the back of a season shooting stags in the Highlands of Scotland to shooting stags in the bush out near Waimate and down near Lake Hawea and stuff. But it's like the same principles apply, you know, and it's all about making sure that we do the best that we can. That's about that, I suppose.
Brilliant, Ben. So My final question, mate, is what keeps you in flow? Do you have a way that you live your life, or a quote or a mantra that keeps things going well, or show you, you call on it if things aren't going so well and get you back in line?
I think one thing that I try to do, I've been fortunate enough to enjoy a lot of different experiences, and one thing that I read somewhere and I repeated to somebody and it ended up when we were getting a mug on it was, you know, great things don't come from comfort zones. And you know, I'm just a normal kind of guy. I can get quite shy like everyone else, but I've found that the best things that have happened have come from pushing yourself into that sort of uncomfortable sense of things. And you know, it's easy to sit back and keep doing the same thing, but you can't expect things to change or things to get not necessarily better, but you know, you can't expect things to change if you keep doing the same thing. And yeah, I think it's about, you know, just being outward focused and kind of thinking about being outcome focused. And thinking about, well, if you do have an aim or a goal, making sure of what that is, but working back from there. Or yeah, it's often difficult to put into place. I'm trying to think as well, like I've recently I saw a few things by this guy Jesse Itzler. He's an American entrepreneur.
Cool.
Oh, I can't remember his wife's name, but she's a Spanx lady.
Oh, like, right.
Yeah, he's but he is his own right.
Yeah.
He has a great strategy. He's well worth a follow. Super positive guy, but I think it's to do with Japanese sense. It's about Maisogi or it's something like that. It's called something like that, and it's about each year doing one big thing.
Yeah.
You know, and then from that working out other branches of things you can do. So yeah, no, I've been keen to I kind of started that last year. Where the big thing was like stop drinking alcohol. Not for any other reason, just from curiosity, and I've just found that I've enjoyed that sort of process. And then since I was coming to New Zealand, I was thinking about, well, that could tie in for the big thing this year. So it's about not being in the comfort zone. So the good old bungee jump at Queenstown's big, because despite spending a lot of time up in the hills and scrambling about bluffs down in Otago and whatever, I'm not that keen on heights. But we're just going to go for it at Queenstown. Yeah. And it'll be right. It'll be better to have done than to do.
Yeah. No, I can sort of, I'm sure it's different for everyone, but it's a weird feeling. I remember it's like 3, 2, 1, and you go to move and your body goes, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
I managed to do a good jump, but yeah, I just remember that moment of my body being like, nah, you're not going. Yeah, no, it's crazy. Oh, awesome, Ben.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's, you've just got to try and make the most of things. I think definitely as you're getting older, as I find myself anyway, you place a lot more value on experiences and doing things. And just got to keep going.
Brilliant, thanks Ben. Been wicked. Learned heaps.
Well, no, hopefully I didn't blather too much, and yeah, it's it is difficult sometimes thinking off the hoof about stuff and what I'm saying.
Legend.
Awesome. Alright, thank you.